A lot has certainly changed since the communist governments of former Soviet bloc nations started to fall like dominoes back in 1989. Considering all the fear and expense that went into the Cold War, I was surprised by how little of this recent history was on display when I first traveled around Eastern Europe a few years later. Well, that's changed now, since new museums and exhibits have opened to show us what life was like back then behind what we called the Iron Curtain. Some of the displays take you to places where atrocities were committed in the name of the state, and some of the exhibits preserve a certain nostalgia for the 1950s and 60s. To help us locate communist-era sites in our travels to Central and Eastern Europe, we're joined now by friends and fellow tour guides who grew up during those transition years in the former Soviet satellites. Katerina Svobodova is from the Czech Republic, George Farkas is from Hungary, and Beata McComas grew up in Poland. Welcome, comrades, to Travel with Rick Steves.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
It was a very strange thing for me as I was traveling in Eastern Europe. I couldn't find the museums I wanted, and suddenly there's these fascinating museums. George from Hungary, how do you attribute the fact that they did not have these museums, and now you've got powerful museums that tell the story?
Because I think we went through the changes, the communism fell, the wall fell, and now we were actually able to reconsider history and actually display it, present it the way it actually was. Therefore, we were able to put together the past and put it into a museum, which we're very proud that we have those things in a museum now, not living them day by day, which I think is excellent. And we're very proud of the fact that we didn't just put it behind and wanted to erase it, because I think it's something that we definitely have to show to the generations following us that this is what happened and this is what we don't want to happen ever again.
For instance, you're from Hungary, and outside of Budapest, the capital city, there's an amazing park filled with statues.
Right.
This must be a beautiful opportunity for somebody to explain to their children what life was like.
Right. Grab their hands and walk out. Have a day trip. The park actually is very exciting in a way that you go into this field, and basically the size of the park already demonstrates what the Russian era was trying to force on our country. So you go into this massive park, and in a U-shape area, you have these statues one after the other, all sort of showing the strength of communism and the message what communism was all about. And I think it's very interesting to learn how those statues got there, because they were all used to standing around us in our parks, by our house, just by our street. And then once the change came, it enabled us to take them down. No one was forcing us to stare at those ever again. And the people didn't want to have them ever again. But the very good thing, which I find, is that they did not destroy them, but they said, let's collect them all and take them to a park and allow the future generation to see them. And if you ever come to Hungary and Budapest and you have a chance, I wouldn't say this would be the first thing to go to, but if you have like a little bit longer time, do go out, visit the park, and by the park, you'll see an amazing little movie on how the era was actually training people to become a spy. Mm-hmm. So you have a full movie, educational movie that was put together by the era, teaching people how to spy on each other.
How to spy on their neighbors.
Right. On their sisters, brothers, neighbors, anybody.
What's the name of the park again?
Statue Park, Memento Park.
Statue Park or Memento Park. And Yes. You've got, there must be 50 statues. They're all propaganda statues.
Definitely.
Social realism, is that
yeah.
what we call it?
Yeah.
When you were a child, they were on the main square, keeping you down, celebrating the communist totalitarian
right.
system.
Exactly.
And today, they're in this sort of fantasy world where they're ranting at each other instead of keeping the people down.
Exactly.
Wow. Katka, in the Czech Republic, are there some sites that help us better understand the communist period?
For the case of Prague, I would say that we have great statues, but not really those what George was describing. But we have by one local artist. He built such a monument opposite the National Street in Prague, but it's very important to the times of 1989, the Velvet Revolution. So across the bridge there, we have there a staircase with bodies made from iron or some kind of metal. And the concept of this, it's the further you go, there are like seven of them, the further you go, the less of the body you see. And there is something about like how the people were broken during the times, either mentally or physically, because it kind of reflects also the people who got to prison, and sometimes we never saw them again. So mm-hmm. they kind of disappeared. So that's why like step by step you go, to see this.
Sort of the individual is rubbed out.
Yeah, that's one thing that's like what is outside. Then we have also a museum. Mm-hmm. It's much more intimate in a way. To me, when I stepped there first time, not knowing much about it, I just wanted to check it, see it. It was like I stepped into my grandfather's garage, the first thing. So all the things I saw there, it was like at home, you know, like, or then I saw classroom, the same kind of a desk I was sitting when I was going to school, learning Russian and all that. So that was quite amazing.
And that's the museum of, it's called the Museum of Communism.
Of Communism in Prague.
Right in downtown Prague. You can't miss it, really.
The interesting fact maybe is that it was opened by one American, you know, because he collected those things. I know him, so
these are museum pieces just from 50 years ago.
That's right, yes. He collected it from his friends, like those new Czech friends, and he put it into the museum. So
and I find it interesting that it's located between a McDonald's and a casino.
That's what I was going to say. That's the most, greatest location found for that.
And Beata, what about in Poland? How can you gain an appreciation of the struggles of the Polish people through communism with your sightseeing in Poland?
I think one museum worth mentioning is in Gdańsk, and it's Solidarity Museum. And doesn't only focus on the Solidarity movement, but also shows how the life looked like under communism. You can actually enter into a store, a grocery store, where there is nothing on the shelves beside the vinegar and empty meat hooks on the wall. You can visit cars that were, well, not many of them back then, but cars that we were using during that period. So
the reality of the life that kept the people down that the Solidarity movement actually rose up against.
Correct.
And the museum is located actually on the site of the shipyard where Lech Walesa and the Solidarity movement started.
Mm-hmm.
It must be very emotional for a Polish person to go there.
It's nostalgic. I think. If I would go there with my parents, they would tell me that probably half of the things that I see there, they owned exactly the same style.
Wow, this is tangible history.
Yes.
Right now on Travel with Rick Steves, we're looking at some of the exhibits and museums that have opened up in recent years in Central and Eastern Europe. They remind us what life was like for them during the years of communist rule and Soviet influence. Our guides are George Farkas from Hungary, Beata McComas from Poland, and Katarina Swobodova from the Czech Republic. George, in Budapest, there's a museum called the House of Terror.
Yes.
Can you explain that museum?
It's a very controversial place sitting on the main square, on the main street, which again leads back to the turn of the century. And the building used to be the headquarters of the Young Hungarian Nazis, the Aerocross Party that was put in charge during the Second World War, when Hitler realized that Hungary is just about to step out and having an idea to step out of the war from the German side. And then it became to be the headquarters of the AVH, the Hungarian Secret Service.
Of the Communist Party. So this was the evil place where you're tortured under the Nazis and under the communists.
Exactly.
The same building.
The very same building.
As a museum.
And I think the greatest twist to it was that it got deserted. And then when the changes came, obviously investors were rushing in and they got the building. They wanted to turn it over to be sort of a startup office. And then they realized that no Hungarians want to enter because it has such a negative feeling to the building. So obviously the business went bankrupt. And then the building later was picked up with the idea of creating the House of Terror, which now actually walks you through the double occupation, the Russian era, how you changed, how you became to be a spy. There's a full-size Russian tank once you step in, oil dripping down the side of it, LCD screen TVs, very modern. And then you finish up your visit down at the bottom with the torturing rooms and the execution places, and you read the names of the lost ones and so forth. So it's a very emotional museum. But at the same time, again, I'd like to say that it's a great place to have to teach the future generation of what had happened in the past.
It is so important that we share this with younger generations so they can defend freedom.
Yeah, exactly.
You call it the double occupation?
Double occupation.
What does that mean?
Well, it was the time when the Germans were already in, the Russians were coming in, and then you really had to prove which side you were on. I mean, it's very interesting. Once you go down and you go into the cells and then you see the name of the lost ones, one would say actually that this very person was imprisoned by the Germans and executed by the Russians.
Oh, my goodness.
And then you're thinking, so which side was he on?
He was Hungarian.
He had to be removed from the society because it was trouble.
Because in each of your countries, you had Nazi occupation and then you had liberation. And you have an Independence Day, really, which was celebrating the entry of your next occupation.
Right, yeah.
George, you mentioned the controversy of having this building where people were tortured, whether under Nazis or communists. Again, all over Eastern Europe, there are new sites where we can learn from this very difficult couple of generations of history. I was just in Leipzig, and they have their Stasi Museum there, and I learned that a third of the people in Eastern Germany were officially informants.
Right.
One third of the population. And after freedom came to Eastern Germany, people had the right, the privilege to look into their files that the government had on them, but many people chose not to, because they didn't really want the heartache of knowing which one of their family members and loved ones and dear friends was actually informing on them.
Right.
Is there that same dynamic in your countries at all?
Oh, yes. As soon as they opened up the files, many files were actually put to be, the government made it top secret for the next 20 years or 40 years or 50 years automatically. So obviously the ones that are still on a political platform might still be on those files that no one have access to read about them. My fiancé's father used to be a doctor, so they actually had quite an access to the system, and they would go down to the Lake Balaton to have a good time, and all the doctors were there, and the professor was there, and you know, the head doctor and so forth. And once the files were open, they all learned that the one that was the host was the one that was putting down information on them. Yet, we must understand that many times these reported informations were absolutely useless, because the question is how one became to be a reporter and what was on the borderline of becoming a reporter. You were put to the corner and say, either you become one or you lose your job. You lose your family, you lose your access for the rest of the world and so forth. So one would decide to do so, and then they would just start writing up silly things that are useless.
So the government's collecting useless information.
Oh, yeah. They would just say, oh, we sat around the fireplace and two had red T-shirts on and we had five beers and we were laughing about this and that. And that went into the file and it got... And then they could tick the box saying that I've done what I was requested to, and then they could carry on with their career. Plus, their families were not discriminated
so you had
from schooling, from any other things.
So the government gave you an impossible choice, really. Either you could
right.
not play the game and your whole family would never get the opportunities and
right.
education, or you play
and
the
I'm
game.
Sure there would be many disagreeing with this because you have a choice to say no, but then you have
it's
to evaluate.
When the reality is there. One of the most poignant things for me was in the House of Terror in Budapest. I remember at the end, they've got all these photographs of all of these people who were in the secret police. Many of them were dead, but many of them were still alive, living down the street.
Right. Yeah.
And Hungary has to live with these people who were the animals of the other regime, and they're still alive right there. And talk about baggage. America deals with baggage. Eastern Europe has a lot of baggage, too. We're getting a close-up view of life in communist Europe in the 20th century in the museums and exhibits that show us what kind of society you'd find a generation or two ago in Eastern Europe. Our guests are independent travel guides Beata Makomis from Poland, Katarina Svobodova from Prague in the Czech Republic, and George Farkas from Budapest in Hungary. Katka, if there's one place you could take me to really understand what the Czech people have gone through as they finally won their freedom, where would you take me?
Well, then I would take you to the Wenceslas Square, because that's the main square in my city, what is tied with both 1968 and 1989 years.
So this is the big square in Prague.
Mm-hmm. I would take you also around a little bit to the National Street. We would basically trace back the Velvet Revolution also, you know, maybe day to day. And so as this is what I remember. But I also do remember 68 just because of my dad.
So the Velvet Revolution was 89 when you finally won your freedom. But you're talking about 68. Which was the sort of the beginning of that in some ways.
That's right. The Prague Spring, when some of our government officials started to do reforms. And of course, once the Russians got to know that something's happening in Czechoslovakia, without any prior notice, they sent about 600 tanks. It was just crazy invasion from five different directions. And I think that local people were at the beginning, you know, very enthusiastic about the changes. That's what I know a lot from my father, because he himself was there in 68 as a 20-year-old boy. He told me, you know, how people all kept together that moment and they just kept going. But then eventually, after a couple of weeks, they basically just, turned back again and went back to their lives. And because of all that, we have one very, very emotional site on the Wenceslas Square. That's a place where a boy actually of the age of like my father burned himself. because of the fact that people stopped, you know, fighting against the Stalinist terror and all that.
In 68, the Czech people rose up, the Russian tanks came in, the people spent their energy and they went back to work, and then this young man burned himself to death to rally the Czech people on.
Yeah, his name was Jan Palach. I would just say that maybe, you know, not to blame just the Russians, because sometimes people kind of simplify this, because I think we should really say that it was the Warsaw Pact and five countries. Speaking about Hungary, Poland, you know, we are here from that former Warsaw Pact, but that time we Czechs were on the other side. But the truth is that the Russians stayed definitely longest. I mean, all the other soldiers were called back while
the Soviets stayed.
Soviets stayed until 89, 90. Yeah.
George, what's one image that you would have from Hungary that you would share to remember what Hungarians have gone through?
I would take you down to the corner of the Parliament Square, Kossuth Square, and we have
a statue in Budapest,
and we have a statue of Imre Nagy, who became to be the leader of 1956.
Imre Nagy. Yeah, and he was the sort of charismatic communist leader of Hungary that really was groundbreaking and standing up against the Kremlin in Moscow.
Exactly. So that's what I would take you to. And then there is a statue of him, there is the parliament, and then I would walk you through the events of 1956 and then carry on telling you what 1956, and then I would probably walk you through the events of that and then outline what happened from that point all the way till 1989 in big steps, where we became to be, again, initiative country to break the Iron Curtain and start the fall of communism.
And Beata, in Poland, where would you take me to appreciate how the Polish people have triumphed with that very difficult reality?
I think I would take you to a church on a Sunday afternoon, after the afternoon mass, so you can see the people. I would try to make you realize that this wasn't the case during communism. Churches were portrayed as gathering places for people conspiring against government. And nowadays you can go to church and pray. But also you can go to church and see tourists from all over the world visiting that place. It's just mind-opening to see people praying and visiting at the same time. So I think I would take it to church.
Beautiful. In fact, I was in Poland, and the experience in the churches that are so alive with Polish people and people from around the world, and the pride that Poland brought us Pope John Paul II, who's now Saint John Paul.
Absolutely. And we had the priest, his last name was Popiełuszko, who died in the name of freedom. He was killed right outside of my city, Toruń. The secret police caught him and drowned him in the lake.
What year was that?
I believe it was 1985.
85, yeah. So this is courage. This is hope. This is people standing up for their freedom. And it's interesting that we had 56 in Hungary, 68 in the Czech Republic, and then the late 1980s in Poland. And today, we're working on it, but we have come a long way. Beata, George, Katka, thank you very much for sharing your country's struggles and your country's triumphs.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'll travel to the east, I'll travel to the west. I don't care how long it takes, I'll never take a rest. I'm not a coming back until you're in my arms. And I can see you night and day with all of your charms. In the moonlight, in the sunlight, in the starlight, I'll search for you. On the highways, in the skyways, on the byways, I'll search for you.
Travel with Rick Steves is produced at Rick Steves Europe in Edmonds, Washington. I'm the executive producer, Tim Tatton. Our associate producers are Kazmira Hall and Donna Bardsley. We get website support from Andrew Wakeling, affiliate promotions from Sheila Gerzoff. Our theme music is by Jerry Frank. Find out when other radio stations air Travel with Rick Steves. You can find a list of our affiliates at ricksteves.com/radio. We'll see you next week with more Travel with Rick Steves.